Okay, so here we go. So we're here's where we're at. So if you look at the top here, 2a, this is the original Mishnah, and then we got off on tangents. But I'm bringing you back here. So I quote from it only to bring us back. So you see, like it starts at 2a, and then discussion really we're going to jump back into is at the bottom of 4a, and then going into 4b. Okay, so just a little recap. It asked the first question that the oral tradition asks. Is from when, that is, from what time does one recite the Shema in the evening? We said from the time that the priest entered to partake of their truma, and until when does the time for the recitation of the evening Shema extend? And the answer was there are three opinions. The first one is until the end of the first watch. That is the statement of Rabbi Lezer. I'm just going to look at the highlighted part. The rabbi said until midnight, and Rabbi Gamliel says until dawn. Okay, those were the three opinions. And we spent a lot of time. We got off this whole thing. What's a watch? What's the first watch? And then that was a lot of the discussion we had last time was what the different watches were. We got into the story with King David, etc., etc. So now the rabbis had their opinion of until midnight. That means that when can you say the Shema at night? Until the second opinion is till midnight. And Rabbi Gamliel said no, until dawn. And that it's all working through. What we came to understand is that the basis of this discussion was when it says in the Shema, when you get up, when you rise, and v'shachbach, I'm sorry, when you recline and when you rise. So the definition of or the time construct for when up until when can you say the Shema at night was defined by how do we understand when it says in the Shema itself. When you recline, does it mean when you go to sleep, or does it mean while you're reclining, basically? Right? So you have the opinion of Rabbi Lezer saying until the first watch is that's pretty much when people go to sleep. That's b'shachbacha, when you recline. Rabbi Gamliel is basically saying the flip side. It's while you're sleeping. So that would be until dawn, meaning people pretty much get up at dawn. Not all people, but that's the idea. That he's defining the idea of reclining as the entire time of reclining. The question is the rabbi's opinion that you can only recite it until the midnight. What does that mean? Are they, how does it go? So now here we get, it brings us to 4a. The Gemara turns to explain what we learned in the Mishnah, and the rabbis say the time for the recitation of the evening Shema is until midnight. The Gemara asks, in accordance with whose opinion do they hold in explaining the verse? When you lie down. If they explain this verse in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Lezer, who says that when you lie down is the time when people customarily go to sleep, then let the rabbis say also that the time for recitation of the Shema extends in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Lezer until the end of the first watch. And if they explain the verse in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel, who says that when you lie down refers to the entire night, then let the rabbis also say that one may recite the evening Shema until dawn in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel, right? So like which, I understand Rabbi Lezer. He's defining when I recline as when people go to sleep. I understand Rabbi Gamliel. He's defining it when up until when people sleep. What's the rabbi's opinion? What are they basing it on? If it's a textual thing, so tell me. It's one or the other. I don't understand where the rabbis fit in here. So the Gemara answers, actually, the rabbis hold in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel. And the fact that they say until midnight is in order to distance a person from transgression. So
Gamliel said you could do it until the morning, right?
Correct, right until dawn. So really, the rabbis agree with his reading of b'shachbacha, when you recline, as to meaning while you recline. Meaning, so, right, it's how do you say u'b'shachbacha, when you recline? Is it when you were going to recline? Which is the time that the Rabbi Elazar said, or is it while you recline, which means while you're sleeping, and when you get up? In the morning, at dawn, okay? So when the rabbis come along, how do they understand it? So the answer the Gemara is saying is, you know what the truth is? They agree with Rabbi Gamliel. They understand the reading of when you recline is the time of when you are reclining, which goes up until dawn. So then why do they say that you can only read it until midnight? They really are setting up a geder, a fence, a protection. They want to prevent us from kind of messing up. And so let's back to the text. As it was taught In the Braita, the rabbis created a fence for the pronouncements with regard to the recitation of Shema in order to prevent the situation where a person comes home from the field in the evening, tired from his day's work, and knowing that he is permitted to recite Shema until dawn, says to himself, I'll go home, eat a little, drink a little, sleep a little, and then I will recite the Shema and recite the evening prayer. In the meantime, he's overcome by sleep and ends up sleeping all night. However, since one is concerned lest he fall asleep and fail to wake up before midnight in order to recite the Shema at the appropriate time, he will come from the field in the evening, enter the synagogue, and until it's time to pray, he will immerse himself in Torah. If he is accustomed to reading the Bible, he reads it, whatever. But if he is accustomed learning Mishnah, whatever it is, a more advanced level of study, he learns, and then he recites the Shema and prays as he should. When he arrives home, he eats this meal and his contented heart and recites a blessing. So, right, so we see the idea is that really what we're saying is that the rabbis agree with Rabbi Gamliel's approach to this understanding of how we read the Pasuk over Shachbecha when you recline is while you are reclining up till the morning. And that the reason that they're setting this up, the midnight deal, is really to set up protection. To make sure that a person doesn't end up, like if you have in your mind, oh, I'll get to it, I have plenty of time. We all know that always leads to bad things, right? You're always like, oh yeah, you know, like you wake up, you know, and
they recognize that human nature is such that you tend to sort of kick the can down the road.
Exactly.
And that without any kind of structure or guidance, you may put it off, so much so that you may eventually miss the opportunity.
Correct. We all need deadlines. That's basically what it's saying, right? So by setting this up, this structure really prevents people from messing up. So we see that the rabbis set up this structure. And the truth is there are other situations where we have this type of thing where you will have a midnight cutoff, but it could have been extended, but they did it in such a way because they want to make sure that we don't have this situation of pushing it off. Okay, so now this is a start and conclusion. What is different in all other places that is not taught that one is liable to receive it? Oh, wait, hold on, I'm sorry. Go back a step. I skipped something here. So the Braita, by the way, just a Braita was written at the same time as the Mishnah. Braitot, you know, depending on how you have a Ashkenazit or Svarit, like with the T. But the Braita was something that was written at the same time as the Mishnah. It didn't get put into the Mishnah, but the way we always understand, when you go through the Talmud, you'll see that there's a hierarchy, depending on what the source is, that will give it greater stature in terms of how we understand something. So, for example, the thing that's in the highest level is the things that are written in the Torah, and then the prophets, etc., the writings. And then, it's Torah, Navi, Suvim. So Torah, the prophets, and then the writings. And then from there, it goes down a notch, and then, you know, considerably a notch will go to anything, again, associated with the Torah. But then, when they call Torah, meaning the five books of Moses. And then you'll get to the Mishnah. At the Mishnaic times, so you had the Braitot and you had Tosefot that were not included in the Mishnah, but were corresponding writings of that time period. So that when you get to the Talmud, you'll see this idea that a Tana, person who lived at the times of the Mishnah, or a Braitot that were, again, corresponding in the times of the Mishnah, will have a much greater authority to that of someone that's a Talmudist. So when you see, like, a Rabbi Akiva, or Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, those are people that lived in the times of the Mishnah. A person that comes along in the Gemara, the Talmudic times, when they come, you'll see there's a reverence that they have that they will never, they'll always, I mean, again, this is not a full 100%, but most of the time they will have deference and they'll say, well, I can't argue on a Tana. So a guy in the Gemara's time will not, he'll say, I can't argue with that Tana, except if he has another Tana that he can go with. So he, like, you'll see, like, this idea. If I have cover, so it's very, it's called legal precedence, right? But here, we, the way we understand it is that the closer you are to Sinai, the greater your the veracity of what you have to say. So that idea, so you see this idea that when you have a braita, the braita is coming from the time of the Mishnah, you'll see, they'll bring in, the, even though, again, it didn't make it to the Mishnah, but it's a writing that comes from that time period, it has a certain weight. So that's what we're quoting here. Here, just as a side, we're quoting a braita here. So now, the braita concludes with the warning. Anyone who transgresses the pronouncements of the sages is liable to receive the death penalty. Whoa, very powerful. Right, so this is a startling conclusion.
I said it too late. Now I'm gonna die.
No. You have no. The idea of
pronounce of the sages.
Okay. So let's see. So that's everything. Always we have to, like, you know. Okay, we could say a very powerful statement. Now let's try to understand what's being said. So this is a startling conclusion. What is different in all of the places that is not taught that one is liable to receive the death penalty, and what is different here that is taught that he is liable to receive the death penalty? Right? There is no unique stringency apparent in the rabbinic restriction on the recitation of Shema. So the Gemara offers two answers, explaining that the conclusion of the Braita essentially stems not from the magnitude of the transgression, but rather from concern that the fence created around the particular mitzvah may be neglected. Right? So how do I get you to take me seriously? You're going to die. Right? So, like, I mean, but the idea is, like, again, to, like, really, like, trump it up a little bit in a sense to make it very serious. So if you wish, say that one returning from work is quite anxious to go to sleep, and due to the risk that he will be overcome by sleep, he must be particularly vigilant in the recitation of Shema. And if you wish, say instead that strong language is employed here in order to exclude the opinion of one who says that although the morning prayer and the afternoon prayer are mandatory, the evening prayer is optional. Okay, so there's this idea when it came to the morning shacharis mincha. Everybody agrees across the board that's an they're obligated. There is an opinion within the evening prayer that it's optional, even though we end up with the halachic decision is that we say that that's also an obligation. There was an opinion that said it's optional. So therefore, so we're saying is, like, you have two things. We're worried about the guy being ready to fall asleep. He's tired. And number two is that there is an opinion that says that the Marav, the evening prayer, is optional. So therefore, it teaches us that the evening prayer is mandatory. And anyone who transgresses the pronouncement of the sages in this regard is liable to receive the death penalty. So the idea is, like, I want you to take this seriously. How do I get you to take it seriously? You're going to be punished, you know? But the idea is to say, you know what? I just want you to understand this is a serious thing. So therefore, when you come back from work, take care of this. This is important. There's also this idea that you might take Marav less seriously because there's an opinion that says it's optional. So therefore, in both these cases, the rabbi said, I need to catch your attention and tell you, take this seriously. So they make this pronouncement of death penalty. So does it mean it that you're going to be punished like that? No, but I think that's exactly what the Gemara is saying here. I want you to take this seriously, and therefore I'm going to couch it this way. But that it's specifically because I do that now you're taking it more seriously. Okay? So mission accomplished. Take it seriously. So that, therefore, the takeaway is that even if you hold, like Rabbi Gamliel, the rabbis say, you got to take this cutoff time seriously of midnight. And therefore, but knowing that midnight's a cutoff, you're going to take care of it as soon as you can and not let it linger. Okay. So now in this braita, the master said that when one returns from work in the evening, he enters the synagogue, recites Shema, and prays. From this braita, we see that at night, just as during the day, one recites Shema and then prays. Okay, so normally the context, we take this for granted, that you say Shema, then you daven Shmona Esrei. Shema, Shmona Esrei. So this supports the opinion of Rav Yochanan. As Rav Yochanan said, who is assured a place in the world to come? It is one who juxtaposes the blessing of redemption recited after Shema to the evening prayer. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says the prayers were instituted to be recited between the two recitations of Shema. So that's a different idea. He's saying Shema, Shemone Esrei, but how, if you're going to say that you're basically Shema's are the things that you're going to work in between, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's opinion is different, because he's going to say one recites the Shema, the morning Shema, then recites the prayers, and only after the recitation of the evening prayer does one recite the evening Shema. That's a different idea. That would mean that comes to Marav, you would say Shemone Esrei first and then say Shema, according to Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Okay? So you have Rav Yochanan who said, you always try to put redemption before the Shemone Esrei. So we say Ga'al Yisrael in the morning, and then you say Shema. I mean, say Shemone Esrei, I'm sorry. So he's saying Ga'al Yisrael, right? He redeemed the Redeemer of Israel, Barachat Hashem Ga'al Yisrael, and then boom, that leads you into the Shemone Esrei. So you're basically saying Shema, and the context of Shema is we have two blessings, the Shema, and then a back-end blessing, which leads us into Shemone Esrei. That's the morning. And at night, you're going to see that we also have this similar to Rav Yochanan. You're saying Shema first and then Shemone Esrei, not like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. So now, although the practical difference between these two positions is clear, the Gemara seeks to determine with regard to what do they disagree. What is the basis of their argument? So the Gemara answers, if you wish, say that they disagree over the interpretation of a verse, and if you wish, say instead that they disagree on a point of logic. So a lot of times you see in the Gemara that they're going to understand, they always look to understand, like they're going to explain how you read the verse, but also sometimes they'll say logic, let's just see logically what makes sense. So now Rav Yochanan and Rav Yehoshua and Levi, they have a disagreement as to how, practically speaking, at night, do you say Shema and then Shemone Esrei, or do you say Shemone Esrei and then Shema? And the question is, what's the basis of this disagreement? Right? Like we saw just before, that the difference between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Gamliel in this whole idea of when can you say Shema until, we said that they basically went to a text. They saw a verse. It says when you recline, and they basically disagreed, or they had a different understanding as to how you understand what that verse is saying. And then practically speaking, we see that there's a difference of opinion. You can only say Shema until the first watch, according to Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Gamliel says, no, it's the whole time you're sleeping, all based on how you read the pasuk, how you read the verse. The same thing here. You have Rabbi Yochanan saying one thing, that you say the order of Shema, then Shemone Esrei, even at night, whereas Rabbi Yehoshua and Levi says, no, you say the Shemone Esrei first, and then Shema. What's the basis of that? So now, it could be based on a verse, understanding of how you read a verse, and it could be how you logically understand things. So if you say that they disagree, back to the text, if you say that they disagree on a point of logic, then the argument relates to the redemption recited after Shema, whose focus is on the Exodus from Egypt, the first redemption. The question is whether that redemption began at night, which would render it appropriate to juxtapose redemption to the blessing of the evening prayers as well, in prayer for immediate redemption, or perhaps the redemption from Egypt only began during the day. Okay, so it's interesting. How do we understand? We're about to celebrate Passover, Pesach, right? So when did the redemption start? At night or during the day? Okay, so let's see. So,
well, I was going to say, it depends what you consider when did the redemption start. Did redemption start with them leaving Egypt? Did it start with the first plague? Did it start with the last plague? When did redemption really start?
Right, well, you can go back to when they even got the message that Moses came, well, and he had this, yes. Right? Right, but here we're just going to focus. We're really focused on that night, that you know, the time of when they were leaving. But it's very well said. It's very interesting because you see the idea. One of the most powerful points that goes on with the redemption is, and we see it in our time, which is very cool. This model is that, like the Balfour Declaration, right? So that when Lord Balfour said that the Jewish nation should have its own homeland in the early 1900s, that was the beginning of the return to Zion, like in an official sense, even though it took many, many years till things really opened up, until the setting up of the state in 1948. What you see in the story of the Exodus from Egypt, that first of all, it's interesting. Moses comes, and they look at him and they say, you know, like, yeah, you. There probably were other messianic guys running around saying that we'll come and save the Jews, but no one took him seriously until Moses came, and he said something that made them take him seriously, and that was at the end of Genesis. If you look at the book of Genesis, the end, Joseph makes them promise. He makes the family promise him that they will take his bones up with them when they leave Egypt. And he says this idea, pakod pakadati, pakod yifkod, that there'll be, that, let me see how you get, I'll get a good translation of this word, this, hold on a second here, let me bring this up. He says to them, like this, like magic saying, it's like a, it's the magic, almost like a code word. Let me just bring it up here. 1 second, it's loading slowly. But okay, so I'll tell you outside and if it ever comes up. But basically, he says to them that the redemption's going to come. Pakod yifkod eschem, that we will be redeemed. Almost like a concept that you can have a message prior to the actual redemption. That's already the starting point. Just to know that that's what's coming, that already is itself enough. And that when Moses comes down and just says these words, Pakod Yifkod, is almost like the Balfour Declaration. It's like way before anything actually happens. But the knowledge, this message that there's going to be a redemption is God bless, is already the major deal. So now bringing back to here, let's see what happens. So we said that there's Rav Yochanan and Rav Yeshub and Levi. They disagree about when exactly the redemption happened. Now, they might not even disagree as to, they're not even, we have this idea, it's called Mitzias. Like, you'll sometimes have a disagreement as to what the facts are, right? So I don't think that anybody's disagreeing here as to what the facts are, as much as how do I understand the facts, okay? So Rav Yochanan holds redemption occurred in the evening as well. However, the full-fledged redemption was only in the morning. So since the redemption began in the evening, it is appropriate to juxtapose the blessing of redemption to the daily evening prayer, right? So that's why Rav Yochanan says, say Shema, and that the idea of Shema is that it's going to lead us to saying, talking about redemption, and that leads us into prayer. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, on the other hand, holds, since full-fledged redemption only occurred in the morning, and the redemption of the previous evening was not a full-fledged redemption, there's no need to juxtapose the blessing of redemption to the evening prayer. So it's a question of perspective. I'm looking for the final, yeah? So the redemption, Shemona Esrei is the prayer. Redemption, whenever I talk about Shema, the way that we build the Shema, the Shema has these blessings before and after it. So the blessings before Shema are always talking about God's greatness in a way and his love for the Jewish people. So the first blessing is always like in the morning, it's very much expanded. And the evening, it's like this one little paragraph. But that, and the same thing for both paragraphs are really like, you know, they're brought in and made like mini version of like what's done in the morning. The morning has a much more expanded. The first blessing of Shema in the morning is talking about God in the upper worlds and his holiness and all that stuff. You look at that and you go through and just praising God and really like expressing God's incredible vastness and holiness and awesomeness. And the second blessing is actually focused on his special connection to us as the Jewish people and his love of the Jewish people. And then us in turn, you know, asking God to be connected to his Torah, etc. That leads us into Shema. Shema, and then from there, after the Shema, you start this whole blessing. And it's similar both in again, the night's a little bit more like abridged. But you have this idea of going through the redemption, like the redemption from Egypt, and that leads us into prayer. This idea of being so mechgula l'tfila, of connecting the redemption to prayer, is almost to say like, we experienced this idea of redemption, and now I come to you, God, and I pray to you, right? Because I've experienced my prayer, or prayer begets us this, or redemption is something that it's like the basis for like, okay, I'll pray because I know that it works because I've seen it work, you know? So that's So the question between Rav Yochanan here and Rav Yoshua ben Levi is that they're just arguing about, how do I look at the redemption? Is the fact that I experience some redemption at night, therefore I feel that there is redemption at night as well? Rav Yoshua ben Levi says, I'm only looking for the final. Like, give me like the full-fledged redemption. Happened when? In the morning. So I'm just looking at that. Okay, so that's a different way of looking at the different perspectives. Now, if you wish, say instead that the dispute between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon Levi is not a difference over a point of logic, but over an interpretation of a verse. Both derive their opinions from the same verse, when you lie down and when you arise. When you rise. Both interpreted that the juxtaposition of this verse, of the recitation of Shema at night and the recitation of Shema in the morning, draws a parallel between them. Rav Yochanan holds the verse juxtaposes lying down and rising. Just as one rises in the recitation of the Shema is followed by prayer, as everyone agrees that in the morning, right, what happens, one juxtaposes redemption to the morning prayer, right? You say Ga'al Yisrael, then you say the Shemone Esrei. So too, you should have the same format. So when one lies down, the recitation of Shema is followed by prayer, right? So you're basically saying, I have a model. What happens is, I know, it's almost like, it's interesting that Rav Yochanan's saying, I have a clear-cut model. I know that in the morning, it's Ga'al Yisrael, it's redemption, Shema/redemption equals then followed by the prayer, Shemone Esrei. So I'm going to follow the same model for nighttime. And we see that. I read it because it was B'shach B'cha V'kumecha, when I lie down and when I arise, are there. They're the same. They're being tied together. They're like a unit. So what I do with one, I should do for the other. And the prevailing thing is that I know that in the morning I'm going to do it this way. So therefore at night I do the same. I follow the same model. Rav Yoshua ben Levi maintains, on the other hand, the verse juxtaposes lying down to the rising in a different sense. Just as when one rises, he recites Shema adjacent to rising from his bed, as the verse says, when you rise means when one awakens, so too, when one lies down, he recites Shema adjacent to lying down in his bed. Therefore, the recitation of the evening Shema should be performed as close as possible to the moment when one actually lies down. Right? So, you see that what? He's saying like, it's all tied to the, it's called samuch lamita. It's connected to the bed, right? So, I say Shema right away, connected to my bed. So bed, Shema, morning, bed, Shema, Shemone Esrei. Nighttime, I should say what? The Shemone Esrei first, because my Shema has to be connected to my bed. That's Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. He's saying, I'm looking at it, Shema's equal time closest to bed. What's interesting is, so now I would say that we paskin like who? Like Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan says that the model is the morning. That just like you see, you say Shema Ga'al Yisrael, Shema redemption, then Shemone Esrei, so too at night. I say Shema redemption, Shemone Esrei. But now, do we throw Rabbi Shimon Levi's opinion out the door? Or do I somehow also feel there's something to what he's saying, that there should be a Shema close to when I go to bed, right? What do you think?
Sure.
Sure what? Okay, meaning Rabbi Shimon Levi basically says that you should always have a Shema close to bed. Meaning, right? So, based on he develops the point to say that I say Shema when I get out of bed. I say Shema when I get into bed. That it always has to be a Shema. When I'm like, almost like when I saw, it's, I, one of my teachers, he said, you know what Shema is? It's like I'm signing in and I'm signing off. So based on the Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, right? I log in and before I go to sleep, I log out. And what's Shema? Hear, O Israel. Meaning it's like I'm talking to myself. I'm talking to the Jewish people. I'm talking to the collective Jewish soul. And I'm saying, I'm logging in. And therefore, I get out of bed. First thing I do is I log in. Shema Yisrael. Hear, O Israel, I'm in. And then at night, before I log out, I say Shema, and then I go to sleep. Log in, log out, right?
Well, it's a
Right, right. So that. Right, so you're saying like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying exactly that, right? So now, but I see, I would tell you like this, the Gemara paskins, I would say, we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan. How do I know that? Because when I open up my prayer book and I look at what's it called? At the structure of the evening prayer. So it goes. I say Shema, and then I say Shemone Esrei. So that's how we paskin. We end up ruling. Paskin equals ruling. So we rule like Rabbi Yochanan in the sense that we say the format of the morning is equal to the night, and therefore I always say Shema redemption, and then the Shemone Esrei. So we clearly go like, we at least on the surface, we're going like Rabbi Yochanan. But in the end, we're going to seem to say like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi as well, because we have this idea that we say Shema Alamita. We say Shema before we go to sleep. So here we see this is a perfect example of we have two opinions and that we really are sensitive to both. We actually are going to say that we hold like both in a sense. We hold like Rabbi Yochanan in the way we have our format for prayer at night. But at the same time, we have this idea of saying Shema before we go to sleep. We log off before we go to sleep. So that would be like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's opinion here, in a sense, meaning a part of his logic is being pulled out and we're using that. Okay. So now just go back to the text. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, it's a mitzvah to recite Shema before evening prayer. Mar, son of Ravina, raises an objection from a Mishnah. How can one do that? We learn in a later Mishnah, in the evening, one recites two blessings prior to the recitation of Shema and two blessings afterwards. Now, and if you say that one must juxtapose redemption to prayer, doesn't he fail to juxtapose redemption to prayer as he must recite, help us lie down, Hashkivenu, the blessing recited after the blessing of redemption, which constitutes a interruption between redemption and prayer. So now, Mar Bar Ravina is asking a question. He says, I don't understand. Rav Yochanan, you're saying that we connect, just like we did in the morning, we do a connection of redemption to the prayer, but I see the rabbis added in this extra blessing, which just seems to have nothing to do with redemption. It's talking about Hashkivenu. We talk about the idea of Hashem, please protect us as we go to sleep. Shomer Yisrael, right? He protects us. So how do you have that? So how, do we really see this idea of connecting redemption to prayer at night? So they say in response, since the sages instituted the practice of reciting, help us lie down, it is considered one extended blessing of redemption and therefore does not constitute an interruption. As if you fail to say that the sections added by the sages are considered no less significant than the original prayers, then one can juxtapose redemption to prayer even in the morning. Didn't Rav Yochanan say, before every prayer, one recites the verse, Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare your glory, as a prelude to prayer, right? We say, Adonai svasai tiftach ufi agiti lasecha. So isn't that also an interruption? We just said, Baruch Ata Hashem Ga'al Yisrael. Blessed are you, Hashem, the Redeemer of Israel. Now we should go right into Baruch Ata Hashem, like start the Shemone Esrei. But we see this line, open up Hashem, svasai tiftach, Lord, open up my lips. That seems to also be a interruption to the idea of connecting the redemption to prayer. So the Gemara afterward, one recites the verse, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be accepted. That's just, you know, that's what we say at the end. But the point is here, it seems to be an interruption. So rather, since the sages instituted that one must recite, Lord, open my lips, it is considered as an extended prayer and not as an interruption. Here too, at night, with regard to the evening prayer, since the sages instituted to recite the blessing, help us lie down, it is considered as one extended blessing of redemption. Okay? Just to summarize here. We basically come out and say that Rav Yochanan's idea of connecting the redemption to prayer at night works as well. The rabbis, the Gemara asks, Mar Bar Ravina asks, I don't understand, there's this added paragraph that seems to be an interruption. The Gemara says, no, that's part of, it ends up being part of the redemption theme. Therefore, it's not looked at as an interruption. What about in the morning or every time? When we say Shemona Esrei, when we're trying to join the redemption to prayer, we say this line of God, open up my lips to be able to praise you. That seems to be an interruption, a break between redemption and prayer. And the Gemara's basic answer is no, that when you say that word, that line of God, Lord, right? Lord, what's the words here? Lord, open my lips that my mouth may declare your glory. That is part of the beginning of prayer. That's the beginning. You're opening up. That's an opening line to prayer. So it is part of prayer. Don't look at it as something that separates between redemption and prayer. It is, by definition, the beginning of the prayer part of the service. Okay? So that's, okay, so now.
You just said that starts prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But they're talking about something before it, and that being an interruption of prayer.
No. I think that what the idea is that at first glance, it looks like it's not part of the prayer.
What I'm saying is, if you're saying that starts prayer, then that means anything before it has ended, and that is now starting prayer, which is different from what's being said here. Unless I'm misunderstanding. You said the words, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart, it's the other one, with my lips, right? It's all with open my lips. Open my lips is the start of prayer?
Correct.
And the argument is that is creating an interruption between the two.
We thought at first glance, basically like this. Think of it this way. I understood, or the Gemara understood, that when I look at prayer, I think of it as Baruch, when it starts with the blessing Baruch. Baruch Ata Hashem. Elokeinu Velokei Avoseinu, right? The Lord of God, Abraham, the Lord of Isaac, the Lord of Jacob, right? That's, when I start with Baruch, blessed are you, that's the beginning of the prayer. That's the assumption. What the Gemara ends up answering is that no, the actual beginning of prayer is Hashem Sefasai Tiftach. Lord, open up my lips.
That my mouth may declare your glory, right?
Correct. That's as an extended prayer. That's how he explains it. So it's not an interruption.
It's a different argument.
Right. So he's basically saying, because it's not that it's an extension of redemption. No. But like we said at night, Hashkivenu, that is an extension of redemption. And the add-ons, whatever add-ons that might be, those are extensions of redemption. And that this Hashem Tzvasai Tiftach is the beginning of the prayer. So, but the Gemara's assumption first was, no, that's some kind of like throwaway line. The Gemara's answer, like when you walk away from this Gemara, you're supposed to understand that when you start saying, Lord, open my lips, is the beginning of prayer. That actually is a start. That's the beginning of the Shemona Esrei. That's what the Gemara is saying in the end here. Okay? It's an important idea. Right, that's the starting point of the Shemona Esrei, of what we call prayer here in this context. Right? So okay? So it's interesting, a takeaway here, again, like we said, that we hold like Rav Yochanan's idea, the understanding of Rav Yochanan's two-pronged approach, his logic, and then his understanding of the verse, we end up saying like him, that there should be redemption at night, because even the beginning of redemption is redemption. So that's why Rav Yochanan says, even at night you have redemption, followed by the Shema redemption followed by the Shemona Esrei. That's how we set it up. And that the takeaway, though, is that we do look at Rav Yehoshua ben Levi's understanding of logging in and logging off samach to the bed, connected to sleep, to when we get up. Right away we say Shema. The first thing we do is Shema, meaning that comes before the prayer. And that at night we say another Shema, like Rabbi Yishum and Levi, so that even though we said Shema, Shemona Esrei, like Rabbi Yochanan, at Mariv, when we get to go to sleep, right before we go to sleep, we're supposed to say the Shema. So much so, I saw recently, I was looking at this, that let's say you say the Shema before you go to sleep, and then you're like up for a half hour, 10 minutes, whatever, that maybe you should even say the first line of Shema again, right before you're about to fall asleep. Almost to say, like, I need to, like, really, like, I want to have that connection, like, almost the sign off right before I actually, you know, fall asleep. It's an interesting idea. So okay, yeah.
Does that mean you say Shema, then Modani?
No, you say Modani first. What he's saying here is, no, because what he's saying is, in the context of prayer being something you'd want to do right away, no, Shema has to go first. Redemption has to be later.
And that's what this is talking more about, the prayer. I'm going to use a bad word, but just for the sake, this is talking about the prayer service, so to speak, or the grouping of prayers that constitute Shacharis Milchemarim, as opposed to when you say you first get up.
Correct. Okay. Right, because it's like, right, because there's like the literal and the figurative, right? We're saying literally, when you get out of bed, say Modani. That hasn't changed. I'm not saying any different. Right, but the first thing I do in my formal prayer type of setting, it's going to be this the way that when we open up our sitter in the morning, that was a whole thing we talked about, the way the prayers are set up. That you have a lot of different things here before you get to the Shema service and then the prayer service, right? Okay, and so now just we have three more minutes or a couple more minutes because Mark's giving a class at 10:30, so okay, we'll go a little. If you're okay, if you can go a little bit more here, just to cover another little point here.
Well, I have one question. Where does this?
No worries. No worries, Lord.
I
got it off of Safaria.
Okay, I just
want to
know where it comes from. Okay.
Yeah. So basically, like when you want to, if you want to get a Talmud, I would get the Art Scroll Talmud. If you want to have the brachos like that, but also the Safaria, which is based off of Rav Steinsaltz, it's fantastic. It's okay. Really, really nice. And then also it has when you click on any specific. Line here, it has it, and it, so I just one of the things that I was working on. We'll get to next time. There's some really unbelievable stuff that's coming up. I want you to jump down. I want to show you something crazy. Just to get this is a takeaway. I saw this last night. I was like, whoa! If you scroll down, you got to just see this one. It starts the paragraph. It starts the paragraph here. This discussion in the Gemara concludes with the Tosefta that arrives at a hierarchy of angels. So first it goes, the paragraph four is Rav Yochanan said. And then after that, the discussion in the Gemara concludes with a Tosefta. You see that? It's page 5. Okay, so it's like 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the fourth paragraph on page 5. You got it?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, great. The discussion in the Gemara concludes with a Tosefta that arrives at a hierarchy of angels based on the number of flights required by each to arrive at its destination. It was taught in the Tosefta, Michael, the angel Michael, as stated above, in one flight. Gabriel in 2 flights, Elijah the prophet in 4 flights, and the angel of death in 8 flights. During a time of plague, however, when the angel of death seems ubiquitous, he arrives everywhere in 1 flight. Okay, so so now I'm going to explain, okay? That's what...
45 minutes ago.
Oh, come on. All right.
I'm finding this so...
I said I'm not doing a good job.
I don't think I'm as well versed in the language of Shemona Esrei, Shema. You know, so I'm sort of like trying to keep up with which prayer does that mean?
Redemption. Right. Okay. Okay. So right. So I'm trying. So we have to. So then the answer to that is, we have to like set it up so that you have A, B, C clear, and then when I talk, when I'm talking, then it, that's very important. So like, I'll try to make that. Okay, but here let's just. I saw this, and we'll come back. We'll go back to where we ended off over there. But let's just hear this one thing. So, whenever the Gemara talks about these things, it's never. You have to understand it's not a literal, but there's something very powerful being said. So the idea of something taking a flight, one flight, two flights. The angels are not physical beings, although. There are certain angels that take on some physicality in certain stories of the Torah, like we see with the angels that came to Abraham, even though there's a lot of discussion there between Maimonides and others as to whether or not that actually happened. Maimonides has a really wild approach that a lot of this only occurred in Abraham's mind alone and not in actual actuality, although the Ramban Nachmanides goes, takes him to task and says, no, these people were, these angels came in physical, manifested physically, either way. Here, when the Talmud's talking about these people, these angels, I'm sorry, not these people, but these angels, Michael and Gabriel, Michal and Gabriel, he is talking about angels that are not physical, but they are taking, they take on a purpose. They have a mission that God is sending them on. Michael expresses the attribute of mercy from God. So that when God acts mercifully, it's expressed in Michal, whereas Gavriel, from the Lashon of Gibor, from the word of might, is more of the attribute of judgment. It's a harsher aspect of God's movements or actions. So then, see, he says like this, Michael comes in one flight. It means that it's more direct. It's almost completely direct without any stop. It's like a one-stop deal. So it's very direct. Gabriel, on the other hand, is two flights. When it comes to din, judgment, it's two steps. It's like it's not completely direct. Elijah the prophet in four flights. So the commentators here explain that Elijah actually is a very complex figure, and it's so apropos. I don't know if you heard my voice note, like this, the Shabbos Haggadah, which we just celebrated, it talks about Elijah coming at the end of days, and he's going to bring the hearts of the fathers back to the sons, and the hearts of the sons back to the fathers. He basically brings reconciliation, Elijah the prophet. So, but Elijah, it says, never died, that he kind of like went up to the skies and never physically died. But Elijah is the one who brings the redemption. He's the messenger that tells us the redemption has arrived. He has certain physical attributes. He also has, spiritual, like he's kind of this mix. And that's the idea of the four flights, is that he's kind of like, he's hampered by being more in the physical realm. Even though we don't see him, but there's a physical element to Elijah. He's never left that physical realm. Part of him stuck. He's like kind of in between. He has this, he's not as agile, so to speak, as these angels that are really like beyond the physical. So he's got the four flights. And the angel of death in eight flights means that the angel of death, God. Yeah. Yeah, there's more of a delay, right? Well, there's more of a delay, okay? And then the eight flights of the angel of death is that God basically set it up so that we have a lot of leeway, that there's more. The angel of death is not coming like that, but rather there's eight flights. It means it's very delayed. There's a real delay in terms of a person's, having to meet their maker, so to speak, at the end of their life.
Okay.
But then the crazy thing is, during a time of plague, however, when the angel of death seems ubiquitous, he arrives everywhere in one flight. Crazy, right? That almost all of a sudden.
Basically, which is what's going on right now.
Correct. like very scary. I saw this last night. I was like, oh my gosh, this is nuts. But the Talmud saying, it's like very like apropos of what's happening here. It's like that's what happens in the times of plague. Like all of a sudden, like where normally God had, or the system is giving us a lot of leeway, and there's this like, you could fight the, you know, there's much more of that. You feel like, okay, like, you know, we have time with this person to work and be able to save their life. At the time of this craziness, you see that there's like, all of a sudden, like things just happen so rapidly that all of a sudden it's like one flight, right? So the Talmud is expressing what we're seeing now. I thought it was so unbelievable. I said, I got to share this with you guys. It's just an incredible, right? When you see a teaching like this, it's like, wow. But you see in the Talmud, like a lot of times when you have these like throw, like, you know, this, like, what's it talking about? Michal, one flight, Gabriel, two flights. There's a very deep, and we just, I'm scratching the surface here because there's a lot more that we could talk about with Elijah and the four steps. But even the first two. But I saw this idea. I said, okay, we gotta, and God willing, next time we get back to this, there's much more there's more to be talked about, but I really wanted to get to that, just touch on that, just because it's so like what we're seeing now. That's scary that when we're in the place of plague, that things really move very quickly in a scary way, because we're so used to being able to, we have a certain, like, we're used to like certain norms, and then when we see it all turned upside down, that it's frightening. The answer, like Rabbi Neuberger, yeah?
The flight is almost like exponential growth of the plague, like 1 versus 2, 4, 8, you know, like that exponential growth. I don't think I can link it.
No, yeah. So he's not, he's saying there, he's just saying that that there's a, that things happen much faster at times of the plague as opposed to normal life. There's a lot more leeway. Things go slower. In times of plague, things just like wreck. Start happening much faster. But the answer, and one of the things that I heard, I mean, at this time of year, with Elijah coming, that message of the end of days, of the idea of reconciliation, is that we have the power to do things, that we can be more careful in how we speak about others, not to speak negative language, Lashon Hara, and to really try to work on repairing any type of, you know, relationships that are need repairing. That makes a big, big dent in these things. And then the second thing is that, you know, in terms of the relationship with God, like the idea, this King David, there was a massive plague during his time. People were like dropping, hundreds of people a day were dying. And at that point, King David instituted the idea of saying 100 blessings a day. Now, with the idea of 100 blessings a day, the number 100 is always like to do something a lot, to do something constantly. So the idea of 100 blessings a day is to be in a place where we're connecting to God also, and recognizing, having a God awareness. To say a blessing with kavana, with proper intent, is to be able to create an awareness of God, that you're bringing God into yourself, into the world, into your reality. So the two things, like really, if you take care of your relationships, if we work on improving relationships with our family members, with our inner family, our extended family, our good friends, or friends that we, or people that we need to repair, if we could do that, and also to be careful about not speaking negatively about others, is so important. It's a very powerful. It is the thing that could literally turn this whole thing around. If people really were more careful about that, it's so powerful. I can just tell you, huh?
About what?
That if a person, if we're careful about not speaking negatively about others and hearing, it's. I could just say from a personal experience, I went through a very difficult period like years ago, and I sat down and I started working on this specific item, and I would say miraculous like protection. It's really that powerful. It says, Miha isha chafetz chayim ohev yamin l'ras tov. Who's the one who wants life? What's the secret to life? Netzor l'shon chamera. Guard your mouth. Guard your tongue from saying bad. I'm surprised that no one's running around and saying to people, you want to be safe from this thing? Just do this. But it's really the answer. I can tell you, it is the answer. You can see miracles from our protection. When you're careful about what you say and how you think about others and thinking positive and only thinking positive and saying positive and not accepting anything negative about other people and about yourself. But it's I'm telling you, hands down, can't be touched. So even like you can go online and find the Chafetz Chaim's writings. They're available. They're widely available. To just take 10 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day to study that with others, with yourself, is earth shattering. It is so powerful. It's the secret. It is the secret. It's that incredible. So I don't know why it's not being expressed more by others, but it's that powerful. All right.
I need to get going.
Yes.